Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, influential 20th century writer Ernest Hemingway lived in Florida for much of the 1930s. We'll visit his home in Key West.
They bought this home in 1931 for $8,000 in back taxes. And still today, it's the single largest residential piece of property on this island.
We'll discuss the life of Alexander H. Darnes, who spent much of his life enslaved by Edmund Kirby Smith.
Despite his highly public life and service and the honors that he earned, Darnes faded from history, and subsequent books on Jacksonville and the medical community omitted his name.
And we'll talk about the old Mount Carmel Baptist Church. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
Sometimes I look at old pictures, smile at how happy we were, how easy it was to be hungry. It wasn't for fame or for money, it was for love. Now my copper hair is gray as the stones on the quay in the city where magic was.
The Mary Chapin Carpenter song Mrs. Hemingway is about Ernest Hemingway's first wife, Hadley Richardson. Hemingway divorced her in 1927 while the couple was living in Paris. Writer John Dos Passos suggested to Hemingway that he may enjoy Key West, Florida, and in March 1928, Hemingway visited the island for the first time. Dave Gonzalez is events director at the Hemingway House and Museum.
He came here for two reasons, really. One was to fish and enjoy himself, and the other was to take delivery of a 1928 Model A Ford Roadster. Now, his plan was to jump in that car and drive it back to Oak Park, Illinois, the Chicago area, and write a little novel or novella about the road trip. Well, he arrived here in March, and the car was not here. So it was delayed from production, and he ended up spending three additional weeks here he hadn't planned on. And at that time, he then fell in love with Key West, the lifestyle, the fishing, of course. The car eventually arrived. He eventually went upon his way. But he kept coming back to Key West over the next 2 years, mostly during the spring months. He'd invite his friends from the Lost Generation. John Dos Passos came down, Waldo Pierce, F. Scott Fitzgerald. And they come down for fishing trips in the spring mostly. But Hemingway would spend 4 to 6 months out of the next 2 years here.
When Hemingway's second wife, Pauline Pfeiffer, found the home that the couple would move into, it was boarded up and abandoned, but she could see its potential. The property was on the highest point in Key West, across the street from the island's lighthouse.
They bought this home in 1931 for $8,000 in back taxes, and still today it's the single largest residential piece of property on this island. We're a full acre, very lush tropical gardens. The mansion was originally built in 1851 by Asa Tift, a wealthy shipwreck and salvaging merchant.
Ernest Hemingway lived in the home until 1939. He was very productive while in Key West. As early as his first visit in 1928, the writer put the finishing touches on his book, A Farewell to Arms. While living in the home that is now the Hemingway Museum, the author wrote the novel To Have and Have Not, the nonfiction book Green Hills of Africa, and short stories The Snows of Kilimanjaro and The Short Happy Life of Francis McComber. Dave Gonzalez.
This was his first writing studio, the secondary building in the rear of the main mansion. Prior to this time, he wrote on tabletops, bar countertops, kitchen tops, coffee tables, wherever he could find a smooth surface to write. They took what was the carriage house, and the upper floor was the hayloft, and converted that upper floor into his formal writing studio. Hemingway is very much a trendsetter. He's probably the developer of something we call home office and teleworking back in the 1930s. There were no roads connecting the last 35 miles of Key West to the mainland, so to visit Hemingway, you had to come by either boat or airplane. There was a ferry. And I kind of like that. If you understand a true writer, when they go into their writing mode, they go into an isolation period. And he certainly isolated himself from the mainland U.S. by positioning himself here in Key West, disconnected and by roadways from the mainland United States.
The Ernest Hemingway House and Museum property is famous for its population of polydactyl or six-toed cats. The cats at the museum today are living history, in a sense, as they are direct descendants of Hemingway's own cats.
There's a folklore legend about them, and you have to understand Hemingway. He was very much a storyteller as a boy that later grew up into a story writer as a man. And when he heard the folklore legend about the six-toed cats, they were the preferred cats on the wooden clipper ships. Ship's captains took them on board mainly because they thought that extra digit, the six toes, made them better mousers, would catch the rodents on the ships. But they also were believed to have mystical and magical powers. They were believed to give ship's captains calm seas, prevailing winds, and safe passages on their journeys. Therefore, they were the preferred cats on clipper ships. When Hemingway heard this folklore legend about the six-toed cats, and they were called gypsy cats as well, he thought, that's a great story. I'd like to have one of those cats. There was a gentleman, his name was Stanley Dexter. He was a ship's captain here in Key West. And Hemingway had docked his boat, the Pilar, down at the Key West Harbor where Dexter was working. And Dexter heard about Hemingway's interest in these six-toed cats and gave Hemingway the first six-toed cat. It was a white, totally white cat. And the mother of the cat was named Snowball. So Hemingway's sons, Patrick and Gregory, they named it Snowball Jr., even though it was a female. It retained a junior. And that was the first polydactyl cat on the property, a six-toed cat. There was a picture of Gregory holding the white cat in our dining room, standing alongside Patrick. And as we say, that was the start of the six-toed cat clan that we have here. Hemingway, being a little bit of a humorist as well, he named all of his cats after famous people. So we still follow that same tradition today. Again, with the app, or if you visit our cat cemetery, you'll see names like Cary Grant, Liz Taylor, Gertrude Stein. Again, the list just goes on and on. Lionel Barrymore, Benny Goodman.
About 50 cats lived on the property while Hemingway lived there, and the same number is maintained at the museum today. People from around the world visit the Ernest Hemingway House and Museum, and tours are available in 9 languages. In addition to the six-toed cats, visitors get to see Hemingway family photographs, original furniture, and artifacts, including the writer's 1932 Royal portable typewriter. Also on the property is the swimming pool installed by the second Mrs. Hemingway.
It was the largest residential pool in all South Florida when first installed. It's 24 feet wide and 60 feet long. It's about 10 feet deep at the far end, 4 foot up on the shallow end. Built in 1937, while Hemingway was off covering the Spanish Civil War, Pauline decides, we need a pool. She removed his boxing ring, he was very unhappy about that, located that over to the Blue Heaven restaurant we know today, and put the pool in. Problem was, in 1937, we weren't going to get fresh running water in Key West until 1944. So it was a saltwater pool. Now, Hemingway was very upset about the pool for, well, 2 reasons. One, he found out the price tag, $20,000 for the pool. They only paid $8,000 for the entire estate. He took a penny from his pocket and told Pauline, you know, if you're going to spend our money that recklessly, you might as well take my last cent right now. He threw the penny at her feet, stormed off out of the yard. She picked up the penny, embedded it into the wet cement, where it still remains today. It's a 1934D copper penny, last pocket it was in, Ernest Hemingway. Now, he left her for Martha Gellhorn, and Pauline stayed here until 1951 with the boys by herself. But she'd still would entertain her Hollywood friends and stars and celebrities and writers and poets. And she'd call all the girls around to poolside at cocktail hour and say, you know, ladies, of all 4 Hemingway wives, I am the only one that can truly say, I took him for his last cent, and there it is. And it's still there, embedded at the pool.
In addition to being appreciated for his concise and direct writing style, Hemingway was known for his fondness for drinking to excess. His favorite bar, Sloppy Joe's, has the writer's face as their logo. The large urinal from the original Sloppy Joe's bar is in the yard at the Ernest Hemingway House and Museum, and of course, there's a story behind it.
Yeah, and Hemingway, you know, regardless of his indulgence, he was a very disciplined writer. He'd write till about noon every day, and then he had something else strictly on his agenda, either to go fishing or down to Sloppy Joe's, depending on the weather. Now, Sloppy Joe Russell was one of his very best friends, and the original Sloppy Joe's is what we know today as Captain Tony's Saloon. Well, the landlord, during the Great Depression in the 1930s, tried to raise Joe Russell's rent $1 a week. A lot of money back then, and it is a matter of Joe Russell just didn't want to pay it. So Joe Russell decided to move his bar across the street to the Sloppy Joe's that we know today, on the corner of Duval and Green Street. But the way he did it, he had a very swift exit out of the old bar. He offered all of his customers a drink if they would help move the bar across the street. So if you picked up a table, a chair, a case of booze, and take it over to the bar across the street, they'd give you a drink for that. And so, after you're finished with that drink, you go back to the old bar and pick up another couple of chairs or a table and a case of booze and bring it over and get another drink. Well, that went on for just a very minimum amount of hours, and the bar was pretty much stripped down. It was lock, stock, and barrel. It was now across the street slinging drinks. But the customers were having to pay for the drinks. So they went back to the old bar to find out what else they could bring over. And there was nothing except for the fixtures in the bathrooms. So they started to rip the toilets and the sinks and the urinals off the walls. They brought them over, and Sloppy Joe said, wait, don't bring those in. We already have restroom facilities here. Just drop them on the sidewalk. They did. He honored the drink deal and gave them their drinks. But we're done moving. Well, Hemingway came walking up that afternoon, and as he approached the new Sloppy Joe's, he saw this urinal sitting out on the sidewalk at the entrance. Joe came out, told him about his new bar and how well he had pulled off the move, and Ernest said, you know, Joe, that urinal sitting there, I think I've put enough money down that drain that I should own it. And Sloppy Joe said, Ernest, what do you want with a urinal? Surely you've got two bathrooms at your own home. He said, yeah, but you know what? I've got 50 cats. I've got about 12 water bowls all over the place. Every time I turn a corner, I kick one over. He goes, if I had that heavyweight, large water fixture, I could fill that with water for my cats. And I could just have one bowl for all 50. And so Sloppy Joe said, tell you what, come on in, have a drink, and I'll help you take it home. Hemingway went in early that afternoon for that one drink, and they came out late that night. The two of them made their way back to this home, looking for the lighthouse as guidance as to where the house was located. And they plopped the urinal in the backyard. Ernest filled it up with water, went upstairs, and went to bed. Miss Pauline woke up the next day, came out to her veranda to gaze at her $20,000 pool, saw the urinal sitting there next to her pool, woke up Ernest, said, hey, get that filthy, disgusting thing out of my backyard right now. He said, look, you move your pool, I'll move mine. Needless to say, the big one didn't go anywhere. Little one remains there today, and it is still today the cat's water bowl with a Spanish olive jar on top, brought over, hand-carried, by Sloppy Joe Russell and Ernest Hemingway.
In 1939, Hemingway moved from Key West to Cuba, leaving his second wife and children behind. He received the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1954, following the publication of his novel The Old Man and the Sea. The author committed suicide in 1961 at his home in Ketchum, Idaho. We spoke with Dave Gonzalez, events director at the Ernest Hemingway House and Museum in Key West.
There's sunset and oysters, Notre Dame's cloisters, time with its unerring aid. And how we can say we were lucky most days and throw a rose into the sand. Now I can say I was lucky most days and throw a rose into the sand.
The This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find great books about Florida history and culture, listen to archived editions of this program, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, historians sometimes use the term hidden or invisible history to describe that part of the past that was experienced by ordinary people, a past that lives in the memories of families and communities and described in oral histories, but seldom includes archived collections of documents and images.
Yes, Charles A. Tingley, Senior Research Librarian at the St. Augustine Historical Society Research Library, brought such a history to light in an article published in the winter 2016 issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly. The article focused on Alexander H. Darnes, a man enslaved to Civil War General Edmund Kirby Smith. Darnes witnessed several battles across the South in the course of the war, transitioned from slavery to citizenship, received 3 college degrees, including an MD from Howard University Medical School, and established a thriving practice in St. Augustine. Yet, as Tingley notes, his history was largely hidden until the 21st century, hiding, as it were, in plain sight.
What did Tingley's research uncover about Alexander Darnes as an enslaved boy and man?
The details of Alexander Darnes' birth and parentage are in dispute, not unlike the nativity of many enslaved people. Various records place his birth in 1840, 1845, or 1846. Likewise, although his mother is identified as Violet Pinckney, several men, both black and white, have been suggested as his father. As a boy and a man, Alexander Darnes appears in correspondence between members of the Smith family, often in regard to training for what was expected to be his life's work, and described using the racial expectations of the era as, quote, affectionate and attached to Edmund Kirby Smith, strong and tall but lazy, as slow as he is long-legged. Similar to descriptions of other enslaved people, these descriptions highlight the views of enslavers toward enslaved people as compliant but unmotivated to improve their lives through hard work. In a letter to Edmund's widow, Cassie Kirby Smith, in 1893, he recounts his experiences during the war. He cites Bull Run, Richmond, Kentucky, Sabine River, Arkansas, and Shreveport as battles he witnessed. As the war was ending and General Smith was in Texas, Darnes successfully escaped Shreveport and made his way with the general's baggage to, quote, General's wife's home, end quote, in Lynchburg, Virginia. His letter exhibits his pride in negotiating the chaos of those final days of the war and in arriving back home with the things Smith had entrusted to his care. His letter does not detail what was the most remarkable part of that journey. Darnes was traveling with Cassie Kirby Smith and her 2 small children, aged 1 and 3. He arranged the passage on a boat headed upriver from Shreveport, but when Cassie Smith's identity was discovered, they were put ashore. Darnes obtained a mule and wagon, drove the little family to a nearby train station, and secured passage to Lynchburg. When he boasted that he brought what General Smith had left in his care, he meant much more than the baggage. Having brought Cassie and the children home, he returned to Shreveport. After the war, Edmund Kirby Smith fled first to Mexico and then to Cuba. Darnes remained in Lynchburg with Smith's wife and children until the general's return.
That's a remarkable story, Connie, but there's much more to it, right?
There certainly is. As Darnes made the transition from enslavement to citizenship, Francis Smith Webster, Edmund's sister, aided him in obtaining an education. He entered the preparatory department of Lincoln University in Chester County, Pennsylvania in 1870, where he undertook a classical education, transferring to the collegiate department in 1872. While at Lincoln University, Barnes was one of 25 students who sued for voting rights. The courts ruled in favor of the students, providing the criteria for establishing legal residency at Lincoln University. He was eligible to vote in the historic 1876 election. From Lincoln University, Darnes entered the medical department of Howard University in Washington, D.C., and graduated on March 2, 1880. Darnes moved to Jacksonville, where he set up his medical practice as the first black doctor in the city and the second in the state. Darnes practiced medicine in Jacksonville until his death in 1894 and earned a reputation within the black and white medical community for his dedication to his patients and especially for his service during the city's smallpox epidemic in 1883 and the yellow fever epidemic of 1888. Like other black physicians, Darnes invested in the community. A member of Mount Zion AME Church and a Mason, he was deputy grand master of the Grand Lodge of the Royal Arch Chapter in the year before his death. He protested the removal of AME Bishop Payne from a first-class rail car in 1883. He provided the first $25 to the Florida Baptist Academy, now Florida Memorial University, and served as the campus physician to Edward Waters College. He opened a bathhouse for black beachgoers at Pablo Beach in 1893. Darnes' final illness and death in early 1894 was covered by Jacksonville newspapers, and a reported 3,000 people attended his funeral. Despite his highly public life and service and the honors that he earned, Darnes faded from history, and subsequent books on Jacksonville and the medical community omitted his name. In 2001, the great-granddaughter of Edmund Kirby Smith, a sculptor named Maria Kirby Smith, approached the St. Augustine Historical Society about designing a sculpture that would include the general and Darnes. Originally conceived as a master-slave scene of teaching Darnes to read, the reconceptualized sculpture titled Sons of the City shows the professor, Kirby Smith, and the physician, Darnes, as affectionate equals. Tingley's article on Darnes was followed in February 2023 with an article in the Smithsonian Magazine about the St. Augustine physician. The extraordinary life of Alexander H. Darnes is hidden no more.
And Connie, we should note that a statue of Darnes' enslaver, Edmund Kirby Smith, stood in Statuary Hall at the U.S. Capitol for a century until it was replaced last year by a statue of Mary McLeod Bethune. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. As Holly Baker reports, the Old Mount Carmel Baptist Church is an endangered historic structure.
The Florida Trust for Historic Preservation's annual 11 to Save list brings attention to the most threatened historic properties and resources across Florida. The Florida Trust has identified Old Mount Carmel Baptist Church in Alachua County as one of the most endangered historic properties in the state. It's been included on their annual 11 to Save list. Located in Gainesville's historic Pleasant Street neighborhood, Old Mount Carmel Baptist Church is listed on the National Register for its importance in the vernacular tradition of African American churches and for its association with the Civil Rights Movement. Ennis Davis is an urban planning consultant and a trustee for the Florida Trust for Historic Preservation. He told me more about Old Mount Carmel Baptist Church.
During the mid-century, the church served as a religious and social hub of the surrounding African-American community and a strategic center where local, state, and national organizations planned legal and nonviolent actions for the civil rights movement in Alachua County and North Florida. The building was the command post for the local National Association for the Advancement of Colored People chapter, as well as a place that hosted discussions about desegregation of the Alachua County school board system and supporting local students involved in the 1971 Black Thursday sit-in to improve racial equity at the University of Florida. Having suffered roof damage and water infiltration, the building has fallen into despair. In addition, residential construction and gentrification in the area threatens the church's historic setting and the continued use as a community gathering space.
Each year, the Florida Trust for Historic Preservation accepts nominations from the public. The nominator for Old Mount Carmel Baptist Church hopes that preserving the church will help educate the community about its connection to the civil rights movement.
The nominator seeks to repurpose and reimagine the old church as a center with spaces and programs and other activities that could address and promote community justice and racial and social equity in the area. I'm happy to say that in January 2023, the National Trust for Historic Preservation announced that Old Mount Carmel Baptist Church would be awarded a $200,000 grant from the African American Cultural Heritage Action Fund. Old Mount Carmel was one of just 35 historic Black churches across the country that will be awarded these grants. So as one of the most threatened historic places in the country, this grant is intended to combat water damage, which will help the institution continue its mission to serve the broader network of nonprofit organizations in the local community within this historic space.
Old Mount Carmel Baptist Church is a two-story late Gothic Revival-style building constructed in 1944. It's significant at the local and the state levels for its association with the civil rights movement in Gainesville and with one of its prominent leaders, Reverend Thomas Wright. Reverend Wright moved from St. Augustine to Gainesville in 1962 after growing threats against him and his family because of his leadership role in the civil rights movement in St. Augustine. He soon became a leader in Gainesville's civil rights movement, where he served as the NAACP chapter president, led public school integration efforts, and planned meetings and marches from Old Mount Carmel Baptist Church. Ennis Davis.
In the period of segregation, the African American church was traditionally the social center and the community hub of the African American communities that it served. African American communities typically could not go into City Hall and voice their displeasure at certain things because of that Jim Crow environment. So the church became that place. So really, without the Black church, there is no civil rights movement, no modern civil rights movement and how it took place, because many of the reverends and preachers, they were able to be civic and community leaders at that time because the way they made money is being supported by the church. They had more opportunity to freely voice their opinions because they weren't economically tied to a system that could hit them personally, which would quiet them. So that's why one of the big reasons the civil rights movement really grew out of the Black church. So Old Mount Carmel Baptist Church is a representation of that national movement in Alachua County. So to learn more information about the push to restore Old Mount Carmel Baptist Church, you can visit saveoldmountcarmel.org.
To learn more about the Florida Trust for Historic Preservation and their annual 11 to Save list, go to floridatrust.org. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Holly Baker, Public History Coordinator for the Florida Historical Society and Archivist at the Library of Florida History in Cocoa.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, find us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Holly Baker. The program is edited by John White. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.